Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We're going to be talking with one of our favorite guests about developments that now are seeming to be emerging with accelerating speed in every single day, involving Israel, involving its struggle with Hamas and other terrorists run by and supported and enabled by Iran, and the Middle East more broadly, and what is happening there that is likely to be, well, possibly harmful in the extreme to not only our friends in the region, but to us as well. That guest would be Rabbi Pesach Walicki. He is a commentator for a marvelous outfit in Israel, Israel 365 News. He is also the host of a marvelous podcast. It's called Shoulder to Shoulder. And he is coming to the small screen to us in the near future, I'm told, here in the United States with some regularity. And we may get him to talk a little bit about that as well. But the main thing is he is an extraordinary resource to this program and I think to freedom-loving people everywhere. And we're always delighted to have him with us. Rabbi, welcome back. It's good to have you.
Thank you, Frank. It's always an honor to be with you.
Let me start by picking up on kind of the news peg of the moment. The now retired Israeli general, Benny Gantz, was invited to come to Washington for a series of high-level meetings with the vice president, the national security advisor, the secretary of state, Senator Mitch McConnell in the Senate, and I presume others. The prime minister of Israel, in whose war cabinet, unity government, Benny Gantz serves, was unaware that he was making this visit, apparently, and was rather irritated when he learned of it. What light can you shed on the nature of this mission, the role that Benny Gantz is currently playing here in Washington as well as in Israel, and what this says about what the Biden administration is up to with respect to Israeli democracy, among other things?
Well, Frank, first I'm going to correct you. Prime Minister Netanyahu was aware that Benny Gantz wanted to make this visit, and he did not. And any visit by a cabinet minister of this sort needs approval of the prime minister, and he did not give his approval for the visit. So the request was made. The answer was no. It's actually worse than him not being aware. He was not. He did not approve the visit. So, look, in order to understand what's going on here, we have to go back a little bit to the comments that have been made by both President Biden and by Secretary of State Blinken, most recently at the World Economic Forum, about how they view the problems in the Middle East. And they have said repeatedly that they view Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, our prime minister, as the problem, as the obstacle. Blinken's words, I don't remember the exact quote, but at the World Economic Forum, he said that Palestinian Arab leaders have readied their population for peace and for a Palestinian state, which is just demonstrably false. It's false from their actions, and it's false based on polling. The overwhelming majority of what are called Palestinians, the Arabs of Judea, Samaria, and the Gaza Strip, oppose a two-state solution. They support Hamas, but nevertheless, Blinken asserts this. Biden asserts it all the time, saying Hamas doesn't represent the Palestinian people, even though polling says that he does. And Blinken went on to say at the World Economic Forum that the question remains: is the Israeli leadership and the Israeli population willing to embrace the same thing? They see Netanyahu as the problem, and that's what this trip is all about. Interestingly, just a couple days before this trip, suddenly there was all sorts of polling without crosstabs, of course, just kind of polling hitting the headlines of our mainstream media, which, like yours, is a tool of the left and a tool of the globalists. Our more progressive mainstream media was releasing polls saying that Gantz would win in an election if an election was held. Of course, polling, there's polling all over the place, and more credible polling really shows that this is not exactly accurate, although Gantz is gaining popularity. This is let me just ask you to
explain one point that you just made, because sure. I think it's relevant to the confidence that one can have in such polls. Crosstabs, of course, is a term used to describe sort of the demographic breakdown of
the details and the
findings.
Poll,
yeah. So you have some basis upon which to say, well, that makes sense, or that doesn't look
exactly
right, otherwise.
Sometimes people will conduct a poll and they'll do it just online through a social media platform, and they'll get a few thousand people to answer it, which in polling generally means you have a credible poll. But if all of the people answering the poll were all funneled through the same social media platform, then they're obviously so self-selected that it makes the poll meaningless. And that's just one example. So anytime one's looking at a poll, you have to be able to see the details and see the crosstabs. And that's why I mentioned that some of these polls are just kind of thrown. I'm just talking about the timing, where there's headlines in the Israeli media just a couple of days ago, right before Gantz announces his trip to the States, saying, oh, look at this. New polling shows that if an election were held, Gantz would win. Which, again, it's actually not true. And I could explain.
But no accident, comrade. Yeah, go into why you think it's wrong.
Well, the reason it's wrong is that while it's true that the Likud party, Netanyahu's party, is, according to polling, going to lose support. If an election were held today, they would get less seats. And just so everyone understands, it's far beyond the scope of this discussion to explain the whole process, but Israel is proportional representation. We have many different political parties, which sounds like chaos, but it's not. It's like factions. You also have factions in the U.S. government. Think about the Republican Party today with the Freedom Caucus and the Rhinos, and you have different factions. So in Israel, those factions are different parties. And for a coalition government to be formed, for there to be a government, there has to be a coalition of 61, one more than half of the 120 Knesset members. So the only way for someone to become prime minister is if they are the head of a party that then leads the coalition. Usually it's the largest party in the coalition, although not always. Naftali Bennett was prime minister, even though his party was not the largest party in the coalition. So in order for Benny Gantz to be prime minister, he would not only need to have his party grow in support, which it is, and Netanyahu's party is getting weaker, but it's not because voters from the right are moving to the left. That's not what's happening. In fact, the Israeli right-wing parties are all growing in strength. Traditional left-wing parties like the Labor Party, which ruled Israel for decades and barely made it into Knesset last time, according to most recent polling, does not even make it into Knesset. The right-wing parties, the nationalist parties, are growing in strength, and much of Netanyahu's support is actually moving to the right. The growth in Gantz's support is largely coming from Yair Lapid's party, which is further to the left of him, which according to polling will be cut in half. And all of those votes seem to be going to Gantz. And if you just do the math, I'm not going to go into the weeds here. It might be an interesting discussion at some point, Frank. But if you just go into the weeds and look at, even according to these polls, saying, oh, look, Gantz's support is growing. Okay, but let's look at where all these votes are going. There is no math. Here's the bottom line. There is no math that would have a situation where anyone could lead a coalition government in Israel. To be elected prime minister, you have to lead a coalition. There's no way a coalition could be formed that includes a will to create a Palestinian state, because there are more than 61. There's closer to 69 or 70 seats in the Knesset in any poll you do, in any election that would be held, that are hardline opposed to a Palestinian state. There is simply, it's wishful thinking by the Biden administration that they could install a prime minister or get one elected who could accede to their demands to create a Palestinian state. Yeah. But that's what this is about. It's about building up Gantz.
This is so helpful. And I guess just to put the finest of points on it, you couldn't get that kind of coalition because the Israeli people do not support it.
Exactly. Exactly.
Hold the thought. We have to take a short break. We'll be right back with more for this full hour of conversation with our friend Rabbi Pesach Wilicki. Stay tuned. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The strategic geniuses who brought us the disastrous surrender of Afghanistan have come up with a new plan. According to Israeli media, Team Biden is prepared to vote for a UN Security Council resolution demanding an immediate ceasefire in Gaza of at least 6 weeks' duration. The difference between these two Biden betrayals is that when we ignominiously abandoned Afghanistan to the Sharia supremacists, it was terrible for our friends, but not immediately for us. We had places to retreat to, although their safety from jihadists will prove fleeting, including here. Israelis have no place to go if the people who lost Afghanistan next save Hamas and presumably cut off further arms to Jews who defy the UN's demands. Americans who truly stand with Israel and understand that her enemies are ours too must powerfully repudiate those poised to perpetrate Afghanistan 2.0. This is Frank Affney.
We're back. We are visiting for this full hour with Rabbi Pesach Walicki. He is the host, co-host of a wonderful podcast, Shoulder to Shoulder. You can follow his reporting and videos and other analyses at Israel 365 News. And Rabbi, I just wanted to make sure that we put into a little bit more domestic political context, if I may, this being, you know, very much an election season after all. What prompted the Biden administration to get Benny Gantz over here at this particular moment in time? You've explained some of the internal dynamics, but what does this say about the administration's efforts to interfere with the democratically elected government of Israel, the more remarkable because Joe Biden is running on a platform, among other things, of his deep respect for and commitment to protecting democracy.
Okay. We can talk about it's Biden's relevant to this topic. For democracy some other time, Frank. I'm sure you and I know, I think we're on the same page in terms of how he even got elected. The entire purpose of the Gantz visit is to paint Benny Gantz as a viable alternative to Netanyahu in the eyes of the Israeli public. Let me explain what I mean by that. You might wonder why a trip to Washington would do that. Israelis, Americans are not, they know that their country's involved in foreign affairs, but Americans don't live in a small country that depends on other countries for support. Israel is a tiny nation, and our only significant ally is the United States of America. And for that reason, Israelis are very sensitive to the relationship that our leaders have with the U.S. So if by building up Benny Gantz, by putting Benny Gantz on stage, shaking hands with Mitch McConnell and Kamala Harris and Tony Blinken and having press conferences in Washington, D.C. and playing the diplomat at this critical moment when the U.S., everyone knows that the U.S. is having trouble with Netanyahu and they're pressuring Israel. By putting Gantz on stage at this moment, they're signaling to the Israeli people by giving him positive press and making it seem like they get along well with him, they want to put the question in the minds of Israelis to say, hey, maybe Netanyahu, even if I like Netanyahu, if he has a bad relationship, if he's got this caustic relationship, this toxic relationship with the U.S. administration, that's not so good for us. Maybe we're better off having someone who the administration gets along with, and therefore they're projecting that. So that's the kind of election interference that it is over here. Now, there were some pundits in Israel who were saying, well, they're going to get Gantz to stand in front of a microphone and pledge his allegiance to American policy and talk about how going into Rafah is not such a great idea, or that or calling for a ceasefire, or even saying that he's open to the creation of a Palestinian state. That's not what happened during this visit. And I'm actually not surprised that it didn't happen. And the reason I'm not surprised it didn't happen, I disagree with those pundits, is that would have been way too transparent. And because the Israeli electorate, especially since October 7th, is quite right-wing and nationalist. It's been shifting that way. We've talked about this in past episodes, Frank. It's been shifting that way for a couple of decades, but especially since October 7th. If Gantz were to say things like that, I'm not even talking about whether he's a man of integrity and he would or wouldn't, but purely politically, if he were to come out in Washington, D.C., where everyone in Israel knows that he defied Netanyahu by going, and if he were to say things like that went against the policy of the government, he would lose a lot of that newfound support. So they're actually being much more clever, and they're having him speak hawkishly in a way that the Israeli population is comfortable with, and they're treating him like a statesman. And this way, Israelis can say, you know what? Even if I like Netanyahu, it's kind of like the Trump thing. There's a lot of people who support Trump's policies and say, you know, I love the guy, but he's got all these legal troubles and everyone hates him and he's got so much baggage. Maybe I'm better off with someone with less baggage. And that's what they're trying to do with Gantz, but it's not working. Only 2 weeks ago, there was, you know, in the polling of just Netanyahu versus Gantz for prime minister, Netanyahu still beats Gantz by double digits.
Wow. Okay, I've been hearing that those numbers are changing, and that Gantz is now in a favorable position vis-a-vis Bibi. But just a quick word on the mechanics of all of this: the administration seems to be set on toppling the elected prime minister of Israel so much that I understand it's pressing for early elections. How does that come?
Well, It can come about if they get enough coalition partners to drop out of the coalition, that the coalition falls. As I said before in the previous segment, in order to have a government in Israel, you have to have a coalition of 61. And
so a vote of no confidence could bring
a down vote of no confidence. A vote of no confidence that passes the 61 threshold forces new elections, and that happens in almost every term. I think only once in Israel's history, maybe twice in Israel's history, a government actually went to term without being toppled. And that sounds like chaos, but it usually happens near the end of a term. But that's how governments fall in Israel. And those of you who follow Israeli politics know we went through a whole bunch of elections in quick succession because the government kept falling and couldn't be formed. So that's how they would do it. There's no appetite in the Israeli population for an election right now. You got to remember, this is a citizen army. And every block and every neighborhood and pretty much every home has people who are fighting or relatives who are fighting, people who have fallen. And we're at war. And that's where the mindset of the Israeli people is. And no one really has an appetite. There is a protest movement. And of course, the media is making waves. But they're trying to get new elections done. And the hope would then be that Gantz's party, which is growing in support, would become the largest party and they would form the coalition. But as I said before, if we drill down and we take a look at all the other parties that you'd form a coalition with, I sat down with pen and paper before this interview, Frank, and I actually did the math myself, according to various polls. So you have 10 seats that go to the Arab party. You have another half a dozen that go to what remains of the Israeli left in either Meretz or Labor coming in. And then you have Yesh Atid, which is Yair Lapid's party, which has dropped. They had 24 seats in the current Knesset. But in the polling, they look like they're getting cut in half. Their polling most recently sees them at 10 or 11. If you just do the numbers, there's no way you get to a coalition that doesn't include either the ultra-Orthodox parties or the hardline defense right-wing parties, the nationalistic parties in Israel. There's just no way to get to 61. And therefore, there will be no way they would ever have a left-wing leaning government in Israel in I think, for the foreseeable future. It's not going to happen.
Especially one that avowedly embraces the policies that the Biden administration is trying to foist upon Israel, which brings us to some of the decisions that are now pending in which the United States government is very directly engaging as well. Specifically, this idea that the Israeli Defense Forces will have to move into the city of Rafah in the south of Gaza to clean out the last stronghold of Hamas. We've got 45.
Listen, Israel will go into Rafah. And right now, this reminds me a lot of the conversations that were taking place in the opening weeks after October 7th, when there seemed to be these delays on the ground invasion, and the Biden administration was working to get Israel maybe to not go in or to not go in with full force. There's a lot of the similar discussions going on.
The northern stretch of Gaza.
Initially. Into the northern part of Gaza. Very similar right now, where on all the news channels, everyone's like, hey, when are we going into Rafah? When are we going into Rafah? It's not, but everyone says it's not a question of when, of if, it's a question of when. Israel will go into Rafah to clean out the final battalions of Hamas.
We will come back to that point and on the other side of a very short break. I hope you'll stay tuned for much more with Rabbi Pesach Walicki, our friend in Israel and a go-to guy on all of these matters. Stay tuned.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa: Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa: Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back. We are speaking for this full hour with the co-host of a marvelous podcast, Shoulder to Shoulder. His name is Rabbi Pesach Walicki. He has a deep understanding of, well, as you could tell by his accents, our two governments and societies, his adopted homeland of Israel and his birth nation, of course, the United States of America. And Rabbi, we were talking about one of the issues that is very much at the forefront of the friction between the government of Israel under Benjamin Netanyahu and the Biden administration. And to hear the press tell it, virtually the entire rest of the world, namely whether Israel will in fact be entering in and cleaning out the last sort of stronghold, if you will, of Hamas in Rafah, in the southern part of Gaza. And you've made it very clear that in your view that absolutely is going to happen. I think to hear the administration tell it, no, there's going to be a ceasefire for at least 6 weeks and hostages will be released. And as I think we've discussed with you before, in their more candid moments, they've actually acknowledged that this is a trap, that once Israel participates in that, there will be no getting out of it. It will be a permanent ceasefire. The point of which is, as is, I think, much of is the American diplomacy at the moment, saving Hamas rather than effecting its complete destruction. So pick up on that point, if you would, and operationally what this means for Israel, especially given the lack of support around the world.
Well, we were talking about polls before. Let me just start with a poll, because about a week and a half ago, there was a poll published by Direct Polls, a very credible polling agency here in Israel, bipartisan. And they asked a very interesting question. Yeah, highly accurate polling agency used by everyone left and right. And they asked a very clever question, very interesting question. The question they asked was, should Israel do an expanded incursion, expanded invasion of Rafah? I'm translating from the Hebrew in my mind. Should they do an expanded invasion into Rafah, even at the expense of the relationship to the United States? Now, bearing in mind what I said earlier, Israelis are very sensitive to the U.S.-Israel relationship. And they polled all Israelis. It wasn't just Jewish Israelis. I'll say why in a moment. 73% of respondents said yes. 23% said no. And the remaining 4% were undecided. Now, I mentioned that it was all Israelis because we have to remember that Israel has 21% Arab minority. And so that either means that they agreed, that minority, or pretty much the entire Jewish population is speaking in one voice, which is very, of course, that's politically where all the power lies.
And that basically all of the opposition to this idea was from the Arabs.
So there's absolutely no way, there's absolutely no reality in which Israel does not clean out the rest of Hamas from Rafah. And it's also this whole attempt to stop them, you accurately put it, it's to save Hamas. At the very beginning of the war, in the opening week of the war, I was roundly criticized by even close friends of mine and family members when I published an op-ed piece saying that as this war progresses and Israel gets closer to destroying Hamas, the United States will pressure Israel to back off. And people were saying to me, why are you saying that? At that time, you know, the U.S. is shipping weapons. There was a carrier group sitting in the Mediterranean off our coast. They were saying all the right things. And
Joe Biden had come to Israel to profess his undying commitment to it.
Yeah. Exactly. And I said, listen, it's very simple. When Joe Biden spoke declaring his undying love for the Jewish people in the state of Israel 3 days after October 7th, he did not call out Qatar for funding Hamas. He did not call out Iran for funding Hamas. Iran and Qatar have invested billions and billions of dollars in building up Hamas. The U.S. considers Qatar a major strategic ally, Joe Biden's words, not mine. And they're negotiating nonstop with Iran and coddling them and giving them money. There's no reality that I can see that those friends of Biden aren't going to pick up the phone and say to him, Joe, you got to stop Israel from defeating Hamas. It didn't make any sense to me geopolitically. And sure enough, here we are. This whole freakout session trying to get Israel to back off as we're entering Rafah to finish the job of destroying Hamas is kind of crazy if you consider the fact that Israel said all along from the very beginning that they were going to proceed city by city until we got to the south and finished them off. And here we are. We're at that point and they're going nuts. Now, I believe, this is pure speculation on my part, but I would say informed speculation, that because Rafah sits, and anyone should look at a map to see where this is, Rafah sits right on the Egyptian border. And Israel needs to control that border, and it doesn't. And I believe that what's really happening here is that if Israel controls that border, they will, first of all, discover tunnels that go underneath that border, and we're going to discover that there was extensive complicity of the Egyptians in the supplying and the arming of Hamas and other nefarious activity. And also it means that they can't send whatever they want over the border, even through the border crossing. The humanitarian aid that has been passing through, which everyone knows has been widely reported and not even denied by the Americans, that 60 to 70% of it falls directly into the hands of Hamas. That happens because when it crosses over from Egypt, the people who receive it are Hamas operatives who are still the government of Gaza. And that's a problem that Israel needs to prevent. And that's really what led to some of the recent problems down there. But the invasion of Rafah is essential. And let's just remember, Frank, that this war could end today if Hamas would release all of the hostages and lay down its weapons and submit to defeat. If they did that, not a single bullet would be fired after that.
Understood. I want to come back to this question of, you know, the difficulties that have been experienced with humanitarian assistance in a moment. But before we do that, the point that you've just made about Hamas's role in both making off with the preponderance of this aid and the use that it's putting it to persist in operations that, if they were to end, would bring this thing to a screeching halt. You know, it was very interesting to me. I think based on a conversation that I had with you, I did a little bit of research recently, and discovered to my surprise that Tony Blinken in December, I think it was December 20th of last year, actually made a statement, I think it might have been a press conference, but made a statement to the effect that this war would be over immediately if Hamas would just surrender. Why isn't that an option that we are, you know, discussing here?
Exactly.
I just have to say, I was astonished because as far as I can tell, that was a blip and it's completely disappeared in favor of now an incessant mau-mauing of Israel at every turn to essentially save Hamas. Your thoughts?
Yeah, and listen, they're still holding elderly women, children. I don't know how many of them are still alive. If people are following closely, something very important happened within the last week, and maybe I don't know how closely your viewers are watching what's happening in the negotiations, but in this whole negotiation of ceasefire in exchange for the release of the hostages, Israel said, we want a list from Hamas of all of the living hostages that will be released if we come to such an agreement. Give us a list of names, and then we can continue the negotiations. Give us a list of names, meaning if we're going to negotiate that you're going to release hostages in exchange for a cessation of hostilities and release of terrorists or whatever, it's fair game. Okay, give me a list of who's going to come home. And Hamas refused to give a list. And Israel said, that's it. It's a non-starter. And they walked away from the table. Now, that is a very telling moment because Hamas desperately wants this ceasefire. And it really signaled that between you and me, Frank, sadly, it probably means a lot of them aren't alive anymore. And the less of them that are alive.
And therefore their value as leverage.
Their value, let's just say it greatly diminishes. It greatly, greatly diminishes.
All right. So let's come back to this humanitarian situation, because the principal argument that's being made about why Israel cannot go into Rafah is you've got 1.x million Palestinians that are all now jammed up there. The Israelis, are being told they have to move them someplace else. In fact, Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, said, Israel can't even consider going into Rafah until it is fed, clothed, and housed those Palestinians. The Egyptians are not allowing them to come into Israel, into Egypt, and even though they seem to have created a buffer zone where they could go. So what's the plan here for getting into Rafah without having this unbelievable bloodletting of innocent civilians?
Well, the plan is to do the reverse of what was done when we went into the northern cities, where we created a corridor southward, which is Israel has created a humanitarian corridor for them to go back to the north. The north is an area that is largely controlled, that is almost entirely controlled now by the Israelis. There's still small skirmishes going on there. There's the remnants of Hamas up there.
Coming out of the tunnels periodically.
They're allowing them to go to the north. And in fact, that's part of what was going on with this humanitarian aid incident, where Israel simultaneously decided that they're going to try to set up a situation where the humanitarian aid does not fall into the hands of Hamas. So they decided that they're going to send the trucks over with Palestinian drivers, but with Israeli army escort, and they're going to bring them right into where the population is and have it delivered directly into the hands of the population in the north, coming through one of the northern border crossings. They're allowing people to go back to the north. And I just heard from one of my sources in the Israeli military that two days ago, there were 85...
Rabbi, I have to ask you to hold the thought. We're just out of time for a moment. Let's take a short break and come back and pick up the narrative, because this is an incredibly important part of the story.
Oh, it's
as to how the rest of the world is going to respond if Israel does indeed go into Rafah. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Thank you.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The strategic geniuses who brought us the disastrous surrender of Afghanistan have come up with a new plan. According to Israeli media, Team Biden is prepared to vote for a UN Security Council resolution demanding an immediate ceasefire in Gaza of at least 6 weeks' duration. The difference between these two Biden betrayals is that when we ignominiously abandoned Afghanistan to the Sharia supremacists, it was terrible for our friends, but not immediately for us. We had places to retreat to, although their safety from jihadists will prove fleeting, including here. Israelis have no place to go if the people who lost Afghanistan next save Hamas and presumably cut off further arms to Jews who defy the UN's demands. Americans who truly stand with Israel and understand that her enemies are ours too must powerfully repudiate those poised to perpetrate Afghanistan 2.0. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back. We are catching up with Rabbi Pesach Walicki, and he is recounting what happened in the run-up to this terrible incident in which we're told as many as 100 innocent Palestinian civilians in the Gaza Strip were killed by Israelis in connection with humanitarian relief. You've given us some very important details about how this incident came about. Reprise that quickly, if you would, and then tell us the rest of the story.
Sure. And I'm going to flesh out the beginning of it because it's really the key point, which is the point of origin of this whole operation, which is that since the beginning of this war, there has been tremendous pressure on Israel to allow humanitarian aid in. And let me point out that early on in the war, at the very beginning, some of your audience might remember that Israel shut off the electricity and the water, and the whole world went berserk. How can you do that? It's a humanitarian disaster. And I bring this up because this war would have ended much more quickly, with much less death, much less destruction, had Israel not turned on the water and electricity at the time. And I think we spoke about this months and months ago, that the reason that Israel cut off the water and electricity at the time and did not allow humanitarian aid in was because of the tunnels, because the Hamas are deep down in the ground in tunnels. They require electricity and fuel in order to keep those tunnels operating. They're like underground office buildings. They have multiple stories in them. These are not normal tunnels. And Israel knew that if they shut off the water and electricity in a very short amount of time, because the ventilation systems wouldn't even bring air down there, the Hamas terrorists would have to come up for air. And that would make the whole war much easier to fight, and it would be much easier to defeat them, ending the war quickly. This push for humanitarian aid was a push really to prolong the war and to resupply Hamas. And that's why Israel resisted it at the beginning. They then, of course, acceded to the demands. They had to. Yoav Gallant, our defense minister, admitted openly back in November that the only reason Israel was allowing the humanitarian aid in, even though they knew that it was prolonging the war and it was against our best interest, was that the United States was forcing us to, and that we need their weapons. So the humanitarian aid immediately started flowing in, hundreds of trucks a day, and these thousands of trucks. I mean, just so much humanitarian aid, and the aid, almost all of it immediately was commandeered by Hamas. A lot of that aid, especially the fuel, people think humanitarian aid is like sandwiches and diapers. A lot of it's fuel, and that fuel went right into the Hamas war machine. And this became a real problem because we knew that the humanitarian aid trucks coming in were prolonging the war and arming our enemy. No army in history would ever do anything like that, but the U.S. was forcing us. So Israel, a couple weeks ago, said, hey, we're going to figure out a way to get humanitarian aid to the people by bringing it in directly, not through Rafah and not through Kerem Shalom, not through the areas that would bring it right into Hamas-controlled areas. We're going to bring it into the north, where the civilians could come and we could give it to them directly. But it's still dangerous because it's kind of a lawless area at this point. The Israeli army is there, But there's a lot of destruction, and there's still Hamas cells running around. And let's remember, Hamas fighters do not wear uniforms, which is, of course, a war crime because it endangers civilians. And Israel, the other day, 2 days ago, arrested, I found this out from one of my sources in the Israeli army, they arrested 85 Hamas members who were part of the crowd migrating back north in the humanitarian corridor. Israel has good intelligence and facial recognition, and there's ways that we can identify these people. They found 85 Hamas operatives. So in the crowds of civilians that are migrating up and down the Gaza Strip through these corridors are Hamas terrorists. When the Israelis brought the trucks in, someone ginned up the crowd into a frenzy. We don't know how. Very often there's provocateurs in there. I could imagine Hamas ginning up the crowd. And here I'm speculating, but there's informed speculation here. Let me explain. I could imagine Hamas ginning up the crowd to start a riot, knowing that the Israelis would have to respond. Because you have to ask yourself about anything, Frank, who gains? Que bono. Who gains from this? Israel has nothing to gain by opening fire on these civilians. But Hamas has a lot to gain by this incident happening. So what happened was civilians started rushing at the Israeli soldiers. And in a situation like this, where there's terrorists embedded in civilian populations and every soldier knows it, and suddenly they're getting attacked, they have these civilians rushing at them. There were soldiers who fired first in the air and then at the ground, and chaos ensued. There was also firing coming from other directions, and that's why the Israeli military says they're going to investigate it, but these deaths did not come from them. And we know that in the past, earlier in the war, Hamas did fire on its own civilians when they were trying to go through the humanitarian corridor. So we don't know what happened here, but let's remember, the only reason that this whole incident happened is that Israel is trying hard to get humanitarian aid to the people without it falling into the hands of Hamas and resupplying them.
So this brings us back to this question of getting sufficient numbers of Palestinians out of Rafah and access to humanitarian assistance without simply, you know, recreating the problem that Israel previously confronted in the north of Hamas operating there and having access to all of this fuel and food and so on. Your assessment of this and the strong sentiment evidently of the Israeli people is that has to happen. They have to get into Rafah. They have to clean that out. Which brings us back to the U.S. policy. What is your current assessment of not just what we talked about earlier, the administration's efforts to undermine the Israeli government, but also to cut off funding for Israel or cut off weapon supply for Israel or vote in the UN Security Council to sanction Israel if it does not get into this extended ceasefire?
Wow. Look, I don't know how far the U.S. administration is going to go. That might have to do with electoral politics. We also
here in the United States, you're talking about
here in the United States.
Saw recently in Michigan as an example. And Rabbi, I forgive me, I did not leave you enough time to answer this question even partially. Okay. So let's just pause right here so you can begin afresh. We're going to talk with Rabbi Walicki about really the critical question now is the Biden administration going to undermine Israel to the point where Hamas is saved and Israel is imperiled? We'll talk about that and much more. Stay tuned for this last segment. Straight ahead. Welcome back. We're concluding this very special conversation with Rabbi Pesach Walicki, a serious thinker and influencer on both sides of the pond, as it's called, about the war that Israel is engaged in. I'm firmly convinced, not only on its own behalf, but on ours as well, a war for Judeo-Christian civilization, really, in a very spiritual war between good and evil. I asked you about the role that the Biden administration is playing, Rabbi, more broadly, not just with respect to undermining Benjamin Netanyahu, but several other uses of leverage against Israel at the moment, and it would appear to the benefit of the Palestinians. You ask cui bono. They seem to be the principal beneficiary. Give us your sense, sir, of where things stand now in terms of the administration bringing, essentially irresistible pressure to bear on Israel, and having it, as a result, make more decisions that prolong the war or may even result in its loss.
Look, this all ties into this humanitarian aid issue. And let me explain what I mean. In the space of 1 week, we have the U.S. government airdropping, partnering with the Jordanians, airdropping additional humanitarian aid into Gaza. Let's remember that the United States has extensive cooperation and an ally relationship with Israel, and Israel is bringing in truckloads and truckloads of humanitarian aid every day. The airdropping in of further humanitarian aid, if we're to take it honestly, what's the goal? Is the goal to get humanitarian aid into areas that Israel's trucks can't get to? You mean Hamas-controlled areas? Is it implying that Israel's blockading? You know, when do you airdrop humanitarian aid in somewhere where you have some hostile government laying siege and you need to get it in? It's a dire situation. Meaning the optics of the airdrop were the point of the airdrop. These people are not starving. You can talk to any expert in starvation for that, you know, simply, you know, and take a look at pictures of the Palestinians. There's definitely a dire situation there. Kamala Harris said that they are, the other day, that they are starving. And then just yesterday, Joe Biden tweeted out that we must get more humanitarian aid in. Now, of course, everything is very carefully scripted. Joe Biden's not writing his own tweets. And that's not even an insult. I wouldn't expect the president of the United States to manage his own social media accounts. But there was this tweet
Donald
that went
Trump
out from Biden.
Famously did, but
well, of course,
others not so much.
Of course, you know, maybe he'd do better if someone else handled the social media account. Maybe. That's an interesting debate we can have. But the bottom line is that if you put it all together with Blinken's statements about how there's a humanitarian crisis, and Kamala Harris coming out with the statements, and the airdrop, which is again all about narrative control. The airdrop was not to bring more humanitarian aid in; it was to project that Israel's not doing enough, that Israel is not allowing enough humanitarian aid in, which is just a way of painting Israel as the bad guy. Now, why is that so critical? It's so critical because the pressure on Israel not to invade Rafah and not to clean out Hamas, because Israel has said from the beginning, we are going to utterly destroy Hamas, especially they are still holding more than 100 of our hostages. They're still attacking us. They're still committing acts of terrorism. So since Israel has vowed to destroy Hamas, and we get closer to destroying Hamas, the only card they have left to play is to paint Israel as the perpetrators of a humanitarian disaster, and as deliberately causing more humanitarian crisis. And that really signals that's the cudgel that they're trying to use against Israel to prevent the utter destruction of Hamas and to prevent Israel from having victory. How far will they go, Frank? It seems like a full court press. On the same day that Benny Gantz was in the U.S. meeting with these officials, Amos Hochstein, who's the Biden administration's special envoy to the Middle East, was also in Israel meeting with our defense minister, and then he went to Lebanon. They are in a full court press to trying to get this war to end before Israel can finish off Hamas.
Yeah.
So I don't know how far they're going to go. I don't know how far they're going to go.
That's an open question at the moment. We will be following it closely with your help, Rabbi Wilicki. I do want to just say, unfortunately, one other factor in applying that strategy is emboldening the rest of Israel's enemies, not only Hamas to continue their fighting, but the Hezbollah, the Houthis, and of course Iran, among others. Rabbi, I'd wanted to close this out, though. There was a piece by our friend Daniel Pipes earlier this week in the Wall Street Journal about Benjamin Netanyahu's plan for the day after Hamas, not the day after the war ends, as has been framed by the Biden administration, but when Hamas is done. What can you tell us about that plan? And is it feasible that we could see something come out of this that might actually be a different Gaza under new management, decent management, as Daniel puts it?
Well, you know, feasibility has a lot to do with the will of a lot of people in charge. So I can't speak to the chances that it'll happen. But one thing I can say pretty clearly is that continuing down the path that we've gone down is not going to lead to peace. Let me talk more directly to that plan. That plan, if some of your listeners don't know, is to do away with the whole Palestinian Authority, Fatah, which is really just the PLO, it's Yasser Arafat's organization, and certainly Hamas and all these other groups, and to instead have full Israeli security control, and to empower the local tribal clan leaders to govern civilly over their populations. And we have to understand, in the Middle East, in the Arab world, this concept of nations, Syria, Iraq, Jordan, is really just like a 20th century kind of legal fiction. It's drawing lines on a map. But the Middle East is tribal and clannish. Like in the Gaza Strip, there are, I think, five clans. That generally govern their areas and their towns. And what Netanyahu is suggesting is really the only thing that could work in this part of the world to have peaceful relations with the Palestinians, which is to empower the local leaders, the local family tribal leaders who are not connected to these international apparatuses of terrorism. And that could lead to peace.
We hope it will, and we have to leave it at that for the moment. Come back to us with further updates on all of this. Rabbi, you are a great national treasure, both American and Israeli. God bless you. God bless all of you. I hope you'll come back to us again next time. Until then, you'll go forth and multiply.